From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bill Moyers retired from weekly television in 2004 at the age of 70. This week, he returns to PBS with a new weekly show. It begins with a documentary called Buying the War, about how the Bush administration sold the war to the Washington Press Corps. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Moyers. Also, we talk with Joshua Ferris about his new novel, Then We Came to the End. It's a satire about office life in a Chicago advertising agency. It's inspired by his own experiences working in an ad agency office. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Moyers is returning to weekly television this week after having retired from it in 2004 when he was 70. His new Friday night PBS series, Bill Moyers Journal, premieres with a special edition this Wednesday. It's a documentary called Buying the War, which explores the role of the press in the lead-up to the war in Iraq and asks why the press didn't do a more effective job in challenging the Bush administration on false or exaggerated claims. I spoke with Moyers about his return to PBS and about how his previous PBS show was secretly monitored by the then head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to see if the show had a left-wing bias. Let's start with Moyers' documentary, Buying the War. Here's a clip in which Walter Isaacson, who headed CNN during the lead-up to the war in Iraq, talks about how many journalists at that time felt constrained from reporting critically on the Bush administration.
There was a patriotic fervor, and the administration used it so that if you challenged anything, you were made to feel that there was something wrong with that. And there was even almost a patriotism police, which, you know, they'd be up there on the internet sort of picking anything a Christiane Amanpour or somebody else would say as if it were disloyal.
We interviewed a former reporter at CNN who had been there through that period, and this reporter said to us, quote, everybody on staff just sort of knew not to push too hard to do stories critical of the Bush administration.
Especially at right after 9/11, especially when the war in Afghanistan is going on, there was a real sense that you don't get that critical of a government that's leading us in wartime.
That's a clip from the new Bill Moyers documentary, Buying the War. Bill Moyers, welcome back to Fresh Air. What are some of the other things you learned in this documentary about how CNN tried to prevent coverage from being too critical of the Bush administration in the lead up to the war?
Well, during the Afghan bombings, which were our retaliation, the U.S. government's retaliation to the 9/11 attacks from the base of Osama bin Laden, CNN reported, showed some of the, you know, what we call collateral damage, the human cost, the human deaths and the human calamities that resulted from our force. And when they ran on CNN, Walter Isaacson and the producers and reporters there heard from what Isaacson called the Patriot Police, the corporate executives, as he says in my broadcast, some advertisers, and in particular the watchdogs on the right who believed that showing anything negative about our response to the Taliban and to Osama bin Laden was un-American. And he felt that pressure every day, he told me in my interview with him.
And he warned his staff, he says, not to focus too much on casualties in Afghanistan and to balance reports on those casualties with reminders of the damages done to America on September 11th.
Yes, he wrote a memorandum, which was finally leaked to the New York Times, and he told his producers, his reporters, his staff, that if they did continue to show the human casualties of American force, they needed also to remind people that there had been the casualties caused by the terrorists at 9/11. And it was his way to try to keep putting into context, because of the pressure he was feeling and getting, to put into context the cause of the bombing that produced the deaths and the destruction from American firepower.
Now, as you point out in your documentary, at the same time that CNN is trying to be very careful about not being too critical about what's happening in Afghanistan and always reminding people that this is a response to September 11th, Fox News is trying to position CNN as being the liberal news network.
And by liberal, they meant, you know, the anti-American, anti-war network.
How effective do you think Fox News was in giving CNN that reputation as being liberal and biased?
I think Fox was very effective. They exploited the emotional sentiments and the passions and the fears that had risen in response to the terrorist attacks on 9/11. And when Pearl Harbor was attacked, many Americans rallied, of course, naturally and patriotically to the administration, the Roosevelt administration. This happened in 9/11. People were uncertain about the sources of this terrorism. They were scared that there would be more of them, and there was a feeling, you know, punch the guys back in the nose, go after them. And I decided to do this. I knew one night late when I was watching the Letterman show, the David Letterman show, and Dan Rather was on, very emotional about the impact of 9/11 on him. He'd been down, looked at the casualties in the World Trade Center. He'd looked up and had seen human beings throwing themselves out of 40, 50-story buildings with flames licking at their heels and hurling themselves to death. He was very moved that night on the Letterman show, and that's when he said, you know, wherever the president wants me to do, whatever the president wants me to do, I will do it. Dan says in the broadcast, in my documentary, that, you know, he regrets that now, although it was a legitimate feeling. All of us were feeling that. My office is only a mile and a quarter from the World Trade Center. My wife and I were there working. We were feeling this these sentiments of, you know, wanting to find out who did it and get back at them. I think that's a natural response. Fox came in, put the flags in their lapels, put the martial music on the screen, and started exploiting that fear and that passion and turning it into a sort of a pro-America, pro-war sentiment, and it put everybody else on the defensive. If you begin to be skeptical of the administration's claims, once the White House started saying that Saddam Hussein was behind this, they'd come after you and say, you know, you're undermining the president, you're undermining the credibility of your commander in chief. What's wrong with you? And that had a very powerful effect on people, on journalists.
Did it have an effect on you ever in the back of your mind when you were having critics on of the Bush administration and during the lead-up to the war in Iraq? Was there ever a voice in the back of your mind saying, this might be divisive for our country to hear this? This might undermine the Bush administration when we need our country to be strong?
No, Terry, I didn't. You have to remember that I was there in the 60s, in the early days of Lyndon Johnson's escalation of the war in Vietnam. And we made so many of the mistakes that the Bush administration began to repeat after 9/11 that I had a strong sense of deja vu. And the fact that I had come out of an administration that had misread intelligence, that had leaped to premature judgments, that had gone to war on a suspicion, made me much more skeptical, I think, than anybody else. I mean, like a veteran of a war, is more skeptical of going back into of what war really is than somebody who hasn't been. So I felt our obligation, that our mission as journalists at that time, was to challenge authority. It was not to take the president at his word. It was to ask the questions that a country needs to know before it sends its men and women into combat. So, no, I never thought that. And, I mean, I had people on who were for the war. It was interesting. The neoconservatives would not come on my broadcast. They wanted to go into friendly, hospitable environments. But I had a number of members of Congress who supported the war. I had others who, journalists who were pro the administration, but I also had a lot of early critics. In fact, it was on my show now with Bill Moyers that Joe Wilson made one of his early appearances, and we now have a record from within the White House that people watch that at the White House and begin to say, this guy Wilson is somebody we have to get after. So, no, I really felt that our obligation as journalists was to ask these questions and give the critics of the war a hearing.
During the lead-up to the war in Iraq, Phil Donahue had a short-lived show on MSNBC. And he says that his show was perceived as too liberal, and he was given certain guidelines to follow to balance the show in the way that the editorial staff wanted it balanced. What were the guidelines he was given?
He says that he was told that he had to have two conservatives for every liberal. And they counted him as two because he was pretty outspoken. But when he would try to have Scott Ritter on, Scott Ritter was the weapons inspector who was reporting from Iraq that there was no truth to these allegations about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. So when he always had to balance someone who was skeptical of the war with at least one and usually two supporters of the war. He says in the documentary, in my interview with him, that came directly from management. When the Donahue show was canceled, MSNBC and NBC, its parent, said, well, it was because he wasn't doing that well in the ratings. Donahue insists that he was holding his own in the ratings, not setting the world on fire, but he was holding his own, and he is convinced, as in fact we learned from another memo, internal memo of MSNBC that was also leaked, we learned that an internal memo at NBC said, look, we don't need the face of a liberal critic like Donahue at this time of a need for patriotism.
Now, a lot of your documentary, Buying the War, focuses on the Washington Press Corps and how you think they bought the war, and Buying the War is the title of the documentary. And you know, an example that you give is, and this is a kind of process example, you talk about the day that Judith Miller and Michael Gordon had a front page story in the New York Times saying that Saddam Hussein was on this worldwide search for materials to build a nuclear weapon and that they'd gotten their hands on aluminum tubes which could be used to build a nuclear weapon. And that same morning, as the New York Times story appeared on the front page, what happened?
Vice President Cheney went on Meet the Press, and when pressed by Tim Russert about the story on the front page of the New York Times, Cheney, who had refused to talk about issues of national security, intelligence like that, said, well, you know, we have it confirmed by the story in the New York Times this morning. Now, that story was a leak from the administration, so you had, in essence, the leaker being asked by a mainstream journalist to confirm his own leak. Wasn't identified as Cheney's leak, although I have no doubt but that it came from Cheney's office, and we learned a lot in the Libby trial about that sort of thing. So it was a sort of, you know, it's a cliche to say it now, but it was a perfect storm or a perfect triangle. The government leaks an intelligence report. It's a wrong intelligence report. It's a false intelligence report, but they leak it. The New York Times prints it, and the talk shows on Sunday confirm it. By actually having the leakers on to say, well, the New York Times says it must be so. Some people in my broadcast say this was the consummate moment when it was clear to them that that there was a collusion or at least an embrace of the administration and the mainstream media, particularly the Sunday, the broadcast networks on going to war.
And another version of how this might have happened is given on your show, and that version is that a third party, maybe Ahmet Chalabi, tells Judith Miller and Michael Gordon about these aluminum tubes, also tells the Bush administration. So when Judith Miller or Michael Gordon goes to the Bush administration to confirm the stuff about the aluminum tubes, they have that information, they'll confirm it, but it's from the same source, and that source is still never... The information is still never really corroborated.
That's right. On my Friday night broadcast, I do an interview with Carlos Bonini. Carlos Bonini is the Cy Hirsch of Italy. He's Rome's leading investigative reporter. He's got a new book out called Collusion, in which he talks about the story of the yellow cake, the story that Saddam Hussein had sent his agents to Niger to buy the so-called yellow cake that's needed for uranium enrichment. And Bonini's book reports with documentation how that story was fabricated by a shadowy figure in the Italian underworld with contacts to the Italian intelligence agency, their CIA, which is called SISMI. Those forged documents and those documents that the President of the United States quoted, in effect, in his State of the Union message, that intelligence from that forged document was taken by Italian intelligence through Silvio Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, to the White House. Berlusconi wanted to ingratiate himself to President Bush, so he was brought this information about Italian intelligence discovering this document that confirmed the report in Niger. Bush was impressed with it. The U.S. intelligence called the Brits in London to see if they had the information. They had the information because Italian intelligence had taken it to them too. So they took it as confirmed. They were both confirming their use of material that had been forged and given to both of them by Italian intelligence. It's the same sort of circular process that was going on between much of the mainstream media in this country at the same time.
My guest is Bill Moyers. His new Friday night PBS series premieres this week with a special Wednesday night edition, a documentary called Buying the War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Moyers, and beginning at the end of April, he's going to be back on PBS with a weekly program that will be called Bill Moyers Journal. It begins on Friday, April 27th, but a couple of days before that, on Wednesday, April 25th, he has a documentary premiering called Buying the War. And the premise of the documentary is that the Washington Press Corps bought what the Bush administration was selling in the lead-up to the war, even though a lot of the information wasn't accurate. Why do you think that the Washington Press Corps bought the information?
First, let me say there were exceptions, and our documentary reports on what the then Knight Ridder Bureau, led by John Walcott, a crusty veteran of many years of covering Washington, and two of his star reporters, Strobel and Landay, I mean, they were ahead of everybody on this story. They were skeptical from the beginning because they had sources deep inside the military at the level of the colonels and the majors, and they had old sources of theirs inside the intelligence agencies and the State Department. And they were on this story from the very beginning, the story that the intelligence was being cooked, that there were real questions about whether or not Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and that Saddam Hussein did not have any ties to 9/11 through al-Qaeda. They were onto the story, but because they don't have an outlet in Washington or an outlet in New York, where the news capitals of America, they were ignored by the mainstream press. But back to your question as to why it happened. Well, first of all, there was the emotional response to 9/11, in which many journalists, like Dan Rather on the David Letterman show, were deeply affected by the sneak attacks that cost so many thousands of American lives, and their judgment of their skepticism was suspended in that time of trauma. It's also the sin of being inside, the sin of in, I call it. I mean, we learned in the Vietnam War that early in the Vietnam War, that if the president said there was a threat, then the reporters and the editors tended to believe there was a threat, but they didn't ask for the actual evidence. It was the reporting of David Halberstam and Morley Safer and Peter Arnett out in Vietnam that very quickly in Vietnam undermined the authority, the official view of reality by reporting facts on the ground. We didn't have that kind of reporting in the build-up to the Iraqi War. There were few American reporters there. They couldn't get to the stories that would counter the official view of reality that was being passed out gratis in Washington. Then you also have, Terry, this powerful ideological partisan press, talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, the bloggers by this time, whose mission is to advance the political aims of the Republican Party. This press is part of a political movement, so that anyone who reports what is contrary to their view of the world, who reports information, news that seems to contradict their principal political leaders, the president and the administration, they come down hard on. So you had the willingness of the mainstream press to go along with the administration because they see themselves as the extension of authority and power, and they're in the game. And you have this relentless beating up of any dissident mainstream journalists who deviate from the official view of reality by political press whose main interest is in advancing the administration's arguments and case.
Because your new documentary examines the coverage, TV and newspapers in the lead up to the war, I'm wondering if you think that there's a kind of false way of measuring fairness that might sound like fairness, but you think maybe isn't really as accurate as it seems, or, you know, in terms of actually measuring fairness?
splitting the difference between two opinions does not get you to the truth. It gets you to another opinion. I believe that we journalists are obligated to get people as close as possible to the verifiable truth, no matter
you're
what.
You're talking about having, like, the guy from the left and the guy from the right and saying, well, the truth is somewhere in between.
The Republican Center, the Democratic Center, is saying, okay, you decide what the truth is. I believe we journalists are obligated to get people close to the verifiable truth, and that the conclusions I reach, the analysis I make, are substantiated by the evidence I've collected. That's what I mean by credibility, and it's what I mean by judgment. We make a judgment based upon the information. Our judgment has to be compared to the credibility of the information. Let me just say one thing about buying the war. People say to me, people have asked me, why is it important today? It happened 4 years ago. Well, this war is still going on, Terry, 4 years after the collusion between the mainstream media and the administration. If your fire department in your neighborhood is in collusion with the arsonist, you want to know about it to avoid the fire next time. If the dog doesn't bark, you want to know if the dog is licking the boots of the burglar.
Is collusion too strong a word?
Oh, I think collusion was a very appropriate word for some of members. Remember, there are a lot of members of the press. Everybody didn't collude, but some did. I mean, the Weekly Standard, Rupert Murdoch's weekly newspaper in Washington, was taking leaks from the Pentagon and printing them and putting them into the argument. No, there was collusion between some members of the press, no question about it, and with the defectors, with Amakcheli, Shalaby, and people like that. There was collusion. In some, there was being used as an innocent or idiot fool.
Bill Moyers' new Friday night PBS series, Bill Moyers' Journal, premieres this week with a special Wednesday night edition, a documentary called Buying the War. Moyers will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Bill Moyers talks about how the former chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting secretly monitored his PBS show to see if it had a liberal bias. And Joshua Ferris talks about his new novel, Then We Came to the End, a satire about office life in an advertising agency. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Moyers. He has a new weekly series called Bill Moyers' Journal that premieres this week on PBS. He's won more than 30 Emmys as well as 9 Peabodys. Early in his career, he served as special assistant and press secretary to President Lyndon Johnson. Moyers last joined us in 2004 when he was preparing to retire from his weekly PBS TV series, which was called Now. You were basically accused by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting of having a liberal bias. And we learned that Kenneth Tomlinson, who was appointed to serve as chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting by President Bush in 2003, had commissioned a study spending $10,000 to investigate whether there was a liberal bias on your program. What have you learned about how that investigation was conducted and what the criteria were for measuring if there was a bias on your show?
Well, what the Inspector General of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and members of Congress learned is that Kenneth Tomlinson did not act in a straightforward and he didn't play by the rules. He misused Corporation for Public Broadcasting money. He singled out now with Bill Moyers for a bias that didn't exist. We know that he was trying to discredit the kind of journalism that we were practicing. He tried to accuse us of promoting a liberal agenda. You know, for years, the right-wing movement has branded anyone who was critical of them or who didn't report the world as they see it as liberal. You know, there's no question. I came out of two liberal administrations, the Kennedy-Johnson administration 40 years ago. There's no hiding the fact that I believe that collectively we can do things that we can't do individually. I don't think markets solve all of our problems. If that makes me a liberal, I'm a liberal. But in my journalism, I believe in trying to get people as close as possible to the verifiable truth. And our reporting was about the very issues, the war in Iraq, the growing inequality in this country, the decline of the middle class, outsourcing, offshore tax havens, all of that, that was at odds with the view of the world being promoted by the ideologues in Washington. And unfortunately, Mr. Tomlinson, whom I had wanted to meet, I wrote Ken Tomlinson three times and asked him if I could come and meet with the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and find out why they were so restless, because I was present at the signing of the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. We believe that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting should be a heat shield to protect the producers and journalists of National Public Radio and public television from the very kind of political motives that were driving Ken Tomlinson and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And, you know, all of this came out in the investigation by the Inspector General of the CPB and by some inquiries from Congress, and Kenneth had to resign from his office. That's the past. I don't know what Ken is doing now. I'm back practicing journalism, and I'm practicing the kind of journalism that either will stand or fall on the documentation and the evidence that we offer for the reporting we do. And that's what I think all of us should be about.
Did you actually get to read the study that Tomlinson commissioned of your show?
No, I mean, I could have, but I didn't want to. You know, he'd hired some old friend of his to do this report that this guy was supposed to watch the broadcast and report to Tomlinson what was on it, who was being interviewed. As I said in a speech I gave after I retired in 2004, voluntarily from the show, all Ken had to do was call me and I'd tell him what was on, or all he had to do was watch the broadcast and he'd find out what was on, or he could even read the TV guide. And I'd offer to give him a subscription to it. You know, to this day, I've yet to have a conversation, despite my calls and my letters to him, with Ken Tomlinson. And I'm going to write him. I hear he's working on a book. I'll be interviewing some book authors on my weekly show. I'll see if he comes on and wants to talk about this. I believe that the job of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is support the independence of producers and journalists in public radio and public television, and whether the Democrats are trying to, you know, we recently had an example of Democrats in Congress, part of the Hispanic caucus, calling the president of PBS up to the Hill to chastise her over the failure of a upcoming series on World War II to include Hispanics. Well, whatever the merits of that case, the very fact that members of Congress feel they can call the president of PBS up to put her on the spot, I mean, that's exactly what we don't want in public broadcasting, and exactly why the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was established.
By the way, if you were to land an interview with Ken Tomlinson, who investigated you while he was the head of CPB, do you think you'd be able to conduct the interview without a hostile tone?
I feel no hostility to him. I'm curious. I'm not a very good devil's advocate either. I like to draw people out, not to argue with them on the air. I don't feel any hostility with Ken Tomlinson. I feel sadness that he didn't understand the mission of his office. But no, I would like to ask him what was his motive, and why does he think that reporting him? He said he was watching one of my reports from a Tamaqua, Pennsylvania, on Now with Bill Moyers. As we had gone down there to look at what was happening to workers who had been the victims of outsourcing and of downsizing, and it was so moving, and their story was so powerful that we gave it an hour. We gave the whole hour to the broadcast. It was really about what's happening to working people in the middle class in this country. Ken Tomlinson told the Washington Post that he was watching that broadcast, and he said, I realized that Moyers had a, quote, liberal agenda, and I was incensed by it. I would like to ask Ken Tomlinson if whether you're liberal or conservative, what's happening to the middle class, what's happening to working people in this country, what's happening to the standard of living for people who live paycheck to paycheck, isn't of concern to all of us as Americans, not as conservatives or as liberals. And there, I'd like to see what his definition of some of the language of words he used might actually be.
I had the pleasure of interviewing your son when his memoir was published, I guess it was about a year ago, about his long addiction to crack and then his recovery and now his work as a vice president at Hazelden, which is a very highly esteemed rehabilitation center. And he reprints in that book some of the letters that you wrote him over the years. And some of those letters are just so eloquent. And it made me think about how few people write long letters like that. Like, everybody emails, but emails tend to be short and functional or funny, but not this kind of like long, reflective, from the heart, really eloquent kind of writing. And it made me really, because the letter as a form for that has kind of died, it made me wonder why you chose the letter as a form to sometimes communicate really profound thoughts to your son.
I started writing letters very early in April of 1954 as a sophomore at North Texas State College. I sat down one Saturday afternoon and wrote a letter to a man I'd never met named Lyndon B. Johnson, who was a United States Senator from Texas and had just been elected majority leader of the United States Senate. That letter, in which I carefully tried to communicate to him why I wanted to be a political journalist and what I thought he could teach me and I could teach him, got to his desk. That's how I wound up working for Lyndon Johnson that summer and sitting outside his desk. And he was a bear about answering every letter within 24 hours. And he said to me, what got my attention was your letter. And I want you to write those kind of letters to people for me. And he would edit and sign them. But he taught me that there's nothing more powerful than the case you make when you are communicating with someone with a pen and a piece of paper, now a typewriter and a piece of paper, a computer and a piece of paper. I never forgot the power of the written word to reach somebody else. And I've done that through the years in letters. I don't really know why I'm in broadcasting, frankly, because I would prefer to write letters. But I wound up in a medium where there isn't the time and the opportunity to be that deliberate. And I guess that's one reason I make so many mistakes in live interviews. But I do learn, I do think the art, the power of communicating privately is in the care you take to put on a piece of paper what you're really thinking, because you know somebody else is going to ponder and receive and absorb it, and you want that person to know what you're really trying to say. So a letter remains the most personal means of communication other than looking someone in the eye and expressing your deepest thoughts of the moment. And that's harder for me to do than it is to put it into a letter. I didn't know my son was keeping those letters. I'd forgotten about those letters, and I was surprised when he was writing his book Broken about his struggle with addiction and his recovery from it, that he had kept them.
Are there people you still write those kinds of long letters to?
Yes, I do. I do. You, for one thing, I write a lot of grant proposals. You know, I have to raise every penny of every. I have to raise every penny of every production that I mount for public broadcasting, and a grant letter is a means of saying, look, here's what I want to do. Here's why it's important. Here's why I need your support. So I still do that. I tell young people that if they really want to reach me, if they really want for me to consider them for a job, write me a letter. Don't call me on the phone. I don't have time, and you don't have time to express yourself on the phone. Write me a letter. I still believe in this verbal and oral age. A letter is the most intimate conversation.
Well, Bill Moyers, thank you for talking with us. It will be great to have you back every week on PBS. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Bill Moyers' new Friday night PBS series, Bill Moyers' Journal, begins this week with a special edition Wednesday, a documentary called Buying the War. Coming up, we talk with the author of a new satirical novel about office life. This is Fresh Air. My guest Joshua Ferris has written a satirical novel about office life in an advertising agency during the end of the dot-com boom and the beginning of the bust. It's called Then We Came to the End. In a front-page review in the New York Times Book Review, James Poniewozik described Ferris as fluent in the language of white-collar wordsmiths under siege and having a sixth sense for paranoia. Poniewozik described the novel as expansive, great-hearted, and acidly funny. Then We Came to the End is Ferris's first novel. Let's start with a short reading from the opening of the book.
We were fractious and overpaid. Our mornings lacked promise. At least those of us who smoked had something to look forward to at 10:15. Most of us liked most everyone. A few of us hated specific individuals. One or two people loved everyone and everything. Those who loved everyone were unanimously reviled. We loved free bagels in the morning. They happened all too infrequently. Our benefits were astonishing in comprehensiveness and quality of care. Sometimes we questioned whether they were worth it. We thought moving to India might be better, or going back to nursing school, doing something with the handicapped, or working with our hands. No one ever acted on these impulses, despite their daily, sometimes hourly contractions. Instead, we met in conference rooms to discuss the issues of the day.
That's Joshua Ferris reading the opening from his new book, Then We Came to the End. Joshua, welcome to Fresh Air. When I first heard about your book, I figured, this will be a not quite as funny version of The Office, which I love. But that's really not the direction you're heading in. Why did you want to write a novel set in an office?
Well, it's hard not to love The Office, and I started this book before The Office came out. The real reason that I wanted to write it was because when I first walked into my first office as, you know, a 24, 25-year-old guy, I was blown away by this behemoth structure. I mean, not just physically, the building itself and all of the cubes and offices, but also psychologically, where you had, you know, closed doors and protocols, secret protocols, conversations that you were picking up bits and pieces of, and strange euphemisms, and it just seemed like it was very good material for a sustained literary effort.
Now the characters in your novel have a very ambivalent relation to the office they work in. You write, how we hated our coffee mugs, our mouse pads, our desk clocks, our daily calendars, the contents of our desk drawers, even the photos of our loved ones taped to our computer monitors for uplift and support turned into cloying reminders of time served. So on the one hand, these people feel really imprisoned by the office, but it's, at the same time, it's kind of their social network.
That's right. The important part of that passage you just read comes directly afterwards when they talk about...
That's why I left it out.
did you leave it out for that specific reason?
No, I'm kidding.
they, They when they find out that they're moving into a new office, all of that boring, dull stuff that they encounter every day, you know, the photographs taped to the monitor and their coffee cups and so forth, sort of brighten in this new, improved space. And so this relationship that they have to their work and to the office that they come in day in, day out, it is ambiguous, you know, it is ambivalent, rather. And it was that was important for me to try to capture, because I think that it's not simply, work is not simply dull, dull, dull. It also provides an astonishing amount of community and a good deal of one's self-identity, particularly with respect to the work people do.
Now, you are in advertising. Did you write advertising campaigns like the characters in your novel do?
Yeah, I was a copywriter, so I gave my hand to quite a few of them. I was never a particularly good copywriter, though, I don't think.
So one of the difficult to fulfill campaigns in your novel is that a client wants an ad campaign for cold sore medication, and they want it to be funny, but at the same time, they don't want people with cold sores to be offended by the campaign.
Right.
So were there campaigns like that that were really difficult to meet that you worked on?
There were, but they were far more dull, unfortunately. They were more like, you know, can we get this guy to move up his anytime minutes in a bill insert from Sprint or something like that? It wasn't quite as interesting and creative. The work that I did personally wasn't as interesting and creative as how can we make a cold sore sufferer into a hero of sorts.
So you wrote those inserts in the bills that we all get that we throw out without
Yes.
bothering to read them.
Yes, I have contributed to your daily dose of annoyance.
Now, one of the complications in your novel is that a partner in the agency is dying of breast cancer. At least that's the rumor. And nobody's really sure or not whether she has breast cancer or she's been diagnosed yet or she's about to be diagnosed or whether she's really sick. But these kinds of projections and rumors and stuff in an office can be pretty absorbing. And I wonder why this aspect of the book, this kind of imagining what's really going on with the partner in the agency, is so important to you as a writer.
You know, the book is told from the group's point of view, and the group is sort of woefully out of touch in certain respects. They get other things exactly right, but because all of the information is being distilled through individuals into this, you know, group of people who might or might not really know the exact score on things, information is not terribly reliable. And I find that that is the case at work. And rumoring itself is sort of a group, very much a group dynamic. And so because it's filtered through so many people and it becomes kind of the group's voice spreading the rumors, it's tough to know what is true and what isn't. In particular here, with respect to Lynn Mason, the character who might or might not have breast cancer, there is something that goes beyond sort of the more craven rumor-mongering that takes place about maybe, you know, somebody's crush on somebody else, or if someone's an alcoholic. Here we're dealing with something that has far more lasting consequences. Is she sick? Is she dying? And that was interesting to me because in some respects, death really is sort of the last taboo that advertising can speak about. Advertising talks in a thousand different ways about sex, and it talks in a thousand different ways about anything, really. Anything is up for grabs in advertising, anything that will sell. But you don't see too many funeral parlors advertising, and you don't see too many Volkswagens being sold on the premise of death. And so breast cancer and advertising don't make very friendly bedfellows. And I was very interested in exploring the limits that advertising has in terms of speaking about that.
My guest is Joshua Ferris. His new novel is called Then We Came to the End. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Hi.
My guest is Joshua Ferris, and his new novel is called Then We Came to the End, and it's a novel set in an advertising agency, basically about office life. How long did you work in offices before leaving that life for full-time writing?
I worked in offices for about 4 years, I'd say. It might have been only 3.5, but let's say 4. And before I worked in advertising, I had many work experiences. I started working actually when I was very young and living in Key West, and I worked in restaurants. And I met a terrific cast of people who, you know, came and went. And then I worked through high school, too. So while I wasn't working in an office with the cubicles and the offices and the hierarchies and so forth, I certainly worked for many, many years and have known that work dynamic that grows up amongst people for a long time.
In your novel, you write, we had these sudden revelations that the daily 9-to-5 was driving us far from our better selves. Did you feel that way when you were working in the advertising agencies? And then when you left, did you become the better person that you felt like your job was holding you back from becoming?
I suspect that I had good days and bad days then, and I have good days and bad days now. That it's no different. I think that what happens is that it becomes so highlighted because you can't get away from the other person's gaze. I mean, sometimes you can certain offices you can close the door and or maybe you have an hour out on the street or eating lunch or something, but you're always sort of under a big brother condition where somebody's always watching. Somebody's always talking. You're always getting roped into conversations, and you're saying things that suddenly either in agreement with the group or you know, against the group, and they all look at you like you're an alien. And it's that sort of pressure cooker condition that makes, that made me anyway, feel as if, all of my flaws are really being highlighted. And if I could just get out and sort of be at home, then I'd be a better person. Likely, it's probably that, you know, I'm just not being seen when I'm being at my worst.
When you started working at home, did the meaning of your desk change? You know, like when you're working in an office, your desk has things that a desk doesn't necessarily need because it's like your station away from home. So you might have like a can opener in it in the way that you wouldn't have a can opener in your study in your home. Right. You might have a picture of your spouse or lover on the desk in the office, but if you're working at home where your spouse or lover lives, you don't really and there aren't other employees around, you don't really need that picture on the desk.
Right.
So did your desk become equipped completely differently?
My desk became such that no other human being should really be forced to look at it because it's so overburdened with crap. And I'm a terrible pack rat, and it's messy, and I would probably be institutionalized if I brought that into a place of, like, commercial business. So I had a lot of stuff on there. But, you know, this, in some sense, it was important for me to take the perception that anybody that works in a cubicle are kind of like they're drones and put that on its head a little bit, because I think that when we go into an office, we're so scared of becoming drones that something primal is kick-started and we do everything in our power to become individuals. That's why we bring the stuff into our offices, you know, the weird posters and the doodads and the snow globes and the knickknacks that sort of define you and make you who you are, in a great effort to kind of break out of that perception that you're just another one of many.
You know, one of the things about having a job is that when you have problems, you can always blame the job. You know, the job can be the source of your unhappiness.
Yeah.
The job can be the source of why you have no time. The job can be the reason why, you know, fill in the blank. And when you don't have like a salaried position, the kind of position where you report for work, and you're working at home writing books, which is what you do now, can you externalize your problems and blame them on something in the same convenient way that you can when you're doing an actual job? you know.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
if it wasn't for this darned book, blah, blah, blah.
You bet. Mm-hmm. My UPS man, mm-hmm. my cat.
What did your UPS man cause in your life?
Oh, actually,
nothing. What can you pin on him?
I absolutely love Joe. Joe comes to the door and he's got a packet, and I try to convince him in to have coffee with him because I'm bored and I don't want to write. And, you know, he looks at his watch. I got a lot of deliveries to make today still, man, so I think I'm going to have to pass. He's actually a great break in the day for me now. But if I need to blame him, I'm happy to. I'm happy to blame my cat that jumps on the printer and starts the copy machine rolling. I'm happy to blame anything other than myself and my lack of ability as I continue to write.
Well, Joshua Ferris, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Joshua Ferris is the author of the new novel, Then We Came to the End. You can catch interviews that you missed by downloading podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. From Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California, fine wines made with organically grown grapes and respect for the earth. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. And from Miramax Home Entertainment, presenting The Queen, starring Helen Mirren, available on DVD April 24th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with presidential historian Robert Dallek about his book Partners in Power, Nixon and Kissinger. Dallek describes the two as self-serving characters with grandiose dreams of recasting world affairs. Join us for the next Fresh Air.